Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Gnar Trees podcast. Today I will summarize and review the book, Coffeeland, One Man's Dark Empire and the Making of Our Favorite Drug by Augustine Sedgwick, is a work of narrative nonfiction that combines commodity history, labor history, economic history, and political analysis. Its central subject is coffee, but its larger purpose is to explain how an ordinary daily beverage became tied to modern capitalism, workplace discipline, global trade, and rural inequality. Sedgwick organizes much of the story around James Hill, an Englishman who built a major coffee enterprise in El Salvador after arriving in Central America in the late 19th century. Through Hill and the plantations he developed, the book examines how industrial methods were applied to agriculture, how labor was secured under coercive conditions, and how coffee moved from tropical highlands into United States kitchens, offices, supermarkets, and cafes. The result is not a simple history of consumption, but a study of the human systems that made coffee cheap, available, and socially indispensable. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, James Hill and the industrialization of coffee agriculture in El Salvador. A central feature of Coffeeland is its focus on James Hill as a way to make the global coffee economy concrete. Hill was not presented merely as an individual entrepreneur, but as a figure through whom Sedgwick examines the transfer of industrial logic into plantation agriculture. Born in Manchester and shaped by an industrial capitalist environment, Hill brought ideas of discipline, efficiency, measurement, and centralized control to coffee production in El Salvador. This matters because coffee farming is not naturally factory-like. It depends on land, climate, seasonal harvests, plant disease, skilled picking, and large numbers of workers. Hill and other planters tried to make this uncertain biological system behave like an industrial machine by expanding monoculture, tightening supervision, and organizing labor around output. The book uses this case to show how capitalism does not simply discover productive regions. It actively remakes landscapes and societies to fit market demand. El Salvador becomes important not only because it produced high-quality coffee, but because its land, labor, and political institutions were increasingly organized around export agriculture. Hill, therefore, functions as both a character and an analytical device, allowing the book to connect personal ambition with a wider transformation in land ownership, rural labor, and global commodity production. Secondly, manufactured hunger as a mechanism of labor control. One of the most distinctive arguments in Coffeeland is that hunger was not only a background condition of poverty, but also a tool used to secure labor. Coffee cultivation required intense manual work, especially during planting, maintenance, picking, and processing. Planters needed a dependable rural workforce, but in areas where people could grow food or rely on communal land, they had less reason to submit to plantation labor on planter terms. Sedgwick shows how the expansion of coffee monoculture and the destruction or restriction of subsistence resources helped create dependence on wages and rations. Hunger therefore operated as a form of coercion without formal slavery. Workers were not necessarily forced by ownership of their bodies, but by the loss of alternative ways to survive. This is important because it complicates the simple distinction between free labor and unfree labor. Wage labor can appear voluntary in legal terms while being compelled by engineered scarcity. The book also links this labor system to contemporary scientific ideas about energy, food, and work. Plantation managers treated workers as bodies that converted calories into labor, revealing how economic calculation could reduce human life to an efficiency problem. This analysis gives the book much of its moral and intellectual force. Thirdly, coffee is a stimulant that reshaped modern work culture. Coffeeland is not only about production in Central America, it also examines why coffee became so valuable to consumers and employers. Sedgwick connects the rise of coffee to changing ideas about energy, attention, and disciplined labor. In modern workplaces, coffee offered a socially acceptable stimulant that helped people remain alert, extend working hours, and adapt to clock-based routines. This argument places coffee alongside broader transformations in industrial and office work, where productivity increasingly depended on regular attention rather than only physical strength. The coffee break is especially important in this analysis because it appears to be a small benefit for workers, but it also served employer interests by restoring alertness and sustaining output. Sedgwick therefore treats coffee consumption as part of the history of labor discipline, not merely taste or leisure. The point is not that coffee caused capitalism, but that it fit unusually well into capitalist demands for wakefulness, punctuality, and endurance. This perspective helps explain why coffee became more than a luxury drink. It became embedded in daily routines as a practical technology of work, linking the tired office worker or factory employee to distant systems of plantation labor and international trade. Fourthly, global commodity chains from Salvadoran plantations to United States consumers. The book stands out because it follows coffee across the full chain connecting production. processing, distribution, marketing, and consumption. Sedgwick does not isolate plantation life from consumer culture. Instead, he shows how beans grown in the volcanic highlands of El Salvador entered broader commercial networks that included exporters, roasters, supermarkets, households, and workplaces in the United States. This structure makes visible the distance between the experience of producers and the experience of consumers. For many drinkers, coffee appears as a familiar grocery item or cafe beverage, detached from land struggles, hunger, and political repression. Coffeeland restores those hidden connections by treating coffee as a commodity, whose price and availability depend on social arrangements as much as agricultural skill. The emphasis on commodity chains also clarifies why consumer demand can shape distant landscapes. As coffee became routine in the United States, the pressure to produce more coffee intensified in places suited to export agriculture. The result was not just trade, but a reorganization of land use, labor systems, and national economies. By following coffee from plantation to cup, the book makes an everyday habit legible as part of a global system. Lastly, political violence and the long consequences of coffee monoculture. Coffeeland links coffee production to the political history of El Salvador, especially the concentration of land and power around export agriculture. The expansion of coffee helped create wealth for a small elite, while many rural workers and indigenous communities faced dispossession, poverty, and dependence on seasonal labor. This imbalance was not stable or peaceful. The book addresses worker resistance, state repression, and the severe violence that marked Salvadoran history, including the 1932 massacre that followed unrest and rebellion during a period of economic crisis. By placing this violence within the history of coffee, Sedgwick avoids treating political repression as an isolated event. It appears instead as part of a system in which land, labor, and state power were aligned to protect a profitable export economy. Coffee monoculture also made the country vulnerable to global price swings, because rural livelihoods and national revenues depended heavily on one commodity. When prices fell, hunger and social conflict intensified. This topic is crucial because it shows that the costs of cheap and abundant coffee were not confined to low wages. They included ecological narrowing, political exclusion, militarized order, and long-term inequality. The book therefore treats coffee as a force that shaped institutions, not only markets. In conclusion, Coffeeland is best suited for readers interested in the hidden systems behind ordinary commodities, especially those drawn to economic history, labor history, food studies, Latin American history, and critiques of global capitalism. It offers intellectual benefits rather than simple consumer advice. Readers gain a clearer understanding of how a familiar drink can connect office routines, supermarket shelves, plantation labor, land concentration, and political violence. The practical value lies in sharpening awareness of supply chains and the social conditions embedded in everyday consumption, without reducing the subject to a narrow ethical shopping guide. Compared with many books about coffee, Coffeeland stands out because it is not mainly a cultural history of cafes, a celebration of taste, or an industry overview. Its originality comes from combining the biography of James Hill with a broad analysis of work, hunger, energy, and capitalism. Sedgwick uses a specific place, El Salvador, to illuminate a global process, which gives the book both narrative focus and analytical reach. It is especially strong for readers who want a historically grounded account of how commodities are made by institutions and coercive arrangements, not only by markets. The result is a serious, readable study of coffee as both a beverage and a structure of power. If you would like to support Augustine Sedgwick, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.